Switch over here.
You'll remember that a few years ago, 2005, we had the World Year of Physics, and that year was chosen to mark the centenary of those astonishing papers by Einstein in 1905. But there was another anniversary that year, which every theoretical physicist should celebrate. It was the bicentenary of the birth of Hamilton. Now, of course, I don't need to say to this audience that his name is very deeply embedded in everything we do. You know, consider the following Hamiltonian. How often do we write that? Well, I'm going to tell you about the prediction made in the 1830s and very soon confirmed that brought instant fame to the young Hamilton. This was a discovery of a phenomenon called conical refraction. It was astonishing then, as I'll explain, and its full understanding is only now, in the last couple of years, been achieved. Now, what was Hamilton's innovation? Well, it was to formulate mechanics and also optics, whose rays he regarded, as we all know, as analogous to the trajectories of particles, in terms of a general scheme involving phase space. Now, that idea, of course, we all know later, it was fundamental in quantum physics, was to consider simultaneously not just the position of the particle, but also its momentum. Now, in simple cases, the momentum is just the velocity or closely related to it, and the speed of a particle is fixed by its energy. So you can say that what remains is direction, and just in three words, what we learn from Hamilton is that he took direction seriously. Okay, that's Hamilton. Now, in mechanics and in optics, the dependence on position is usually non-trivial. You know, forces depend on position, refractive indices in varying media depend on position. But when there are no magnetic fields, for example, the motion of a particle is not influenced by its direction. And I'm sure we all had the same experience, that when we first learned Hamiltonian mechanics, this emphasis on equality of position and direction did seem a bit artificial. But in the optics of crystals, the refractive index, which governed the propagation, depend on direction. Could we reverse whatever you did? Thank you. Thank you. No, that's fine, actually. Could you reverse it again? Thank you. That's fine. Thank you very much. I prefer it because there's something about the optics of this room which is sabotaging to lecturers, because these lights which shine on the so it can't be. Is it okay, by the way, like this? Here it is. All right. That's not going to be better. But in optics of crystals, the refractive indices which govern the propagation do depend on direction, and indeed, crystal optics is a symphony of directions. You'll see this as we proceed. And so crystal optics was the natural arena for Hamilton to develop his ideas. So let me begin with something elementary that you've all learned, but I remind you because it's not something that in most of our daily lives we do work on, which is optics of polarized light. The basic optics of crystals, which was before Hamilton, actually. Well, in any direction in a transparent material, two light waves can travel, and they're polarized orthogonally, and they have different refractive indices. So that's the picture. Before Hamilton, Fresnel encapsulated some of this behavior in something called the wave surface, which we now would call the Hamiltonian surface in phase space, in momentum space. But it's the dependence of refractive indices on direction. It's a polar plot. And of course, there are two surfaces because there are two waves that travel at different speeds. So here's a direction of a wave that's traveling. And here are the two refractive indices. And of course, as you span the space of directions, you will create two surfaces, which are called collectively the wave surface. Now, what's the shape of it? Well, if you have an isotropic material, it's a trivial, empty construction. They're just two coincident spheres, water, air, glass, and whatever. The next case is if one direction is distinguished and the other two are not. This depends on the crystal symmetry. And then For example, calcite is like this, or cellophane, which you often use in elementary demonstrations of polarization. Then one surface is a sphere and the other is an ellipsoid, and you only see what the surface consists of if you put them together. So do that, and they touch at two points on the optic axis. There's just one such axis, and so these are called uniaxial crystals, because there's one axis. But Hamilton was concerned with the most general case, for which there were formulas, but nobody had really understood the shape. And in the most general case, where all three refractive indices are different, in what was later Maxwell's theory, all three eigenvalues of the dielectric tensor are distinct, then, for example, a material used in those days, and I'll talk about real materials in a while, was aragonite. It's a variant of calcium carbonate, but it's monoclinic. It has all three axes different, that the surfaces are like this. One is dimpled and one is bumpy, the dimples and bumps. And once again, if you put them together, only then do you understand what the shapes is, and that's the shape, okay, cut in half. And Hamilton drew attention to the fact that you've got these four singularities, four points where the surfaces intersect, where the crystal is locally isotropic because the two indices are the same, on two optic axes, and so these are called biaxial crystals, and that's the general case. And he homed in on this neighbourhood here, because he realised it was interesting, and the intersection is a double cone, a diabolo. Later we will see, or maybe we won't see, but I'll tell you now, that this point is a degeneracy of a matrix that depends on two parameters, real symmetric matrix. And so this is the organizing center of degenerate behavior, and so that's why I call this a diabolical singularity, which is of the title. So that's what it is Hamilton's diabolical point in momentum space, right? And the optic axis is a slant, which is a nuisance in calculations, but doesn't play any role I need to emphasize from now on. Now, he knew another thing which enabled him to predict something based on this insight, which is this. He knew that the wave direction in a crystal that I've been talking about, these directions of the perpendicular to the wave fronts, is not the same as the ray direction along which the energy flows. Nowadays we call that Hamiltonian's first equation. R dot V is not in the same direction as P, okay, in general. I mean, it is in simple trivial cases, but not here. So he knew that, and so here are the here's the wave direction, here are the wave fronts, and here's the ray direction. He knew the rule, which, as I say, is Hamilton's first equation, but geometrically it's that the rays are at right angles to the wave surface. So here's the wave direction and here's the ray direction. Now, he realized that if you combine this with his understanding of this conical singularity, you can predict something which was at the time very surprising. Because you see, in almost every wave direction, since there are two sheets, there are two rays. And that's why this whole subject is called double refraction. But if a ray is incident in the diabolical direction, then there are infinitely many normals, and instead of two rays, you get infinitely many. And in fact, the infinitely many rays forms a complementary cone. Here's the picture. Here's the wave cone I've talked about. Usually these angles are small, a degree or so. And here's the ray cone at right angles to it. And the optic axis actually is a generator there. And he realized that something, that if you take a crystal slab and you cut it at right angles to this optic axis and shine a narrow beam of light in, then what will happen will be that this beam will spread into a hollow cone inside the crystal. Outside, each of those rays will refract out and you'll get a hollow cylinder of light. And if you put a screen there, you should see a ring. Now, this was very surprising to people. Especially his colleague, the Reverend Humphrey Lloyd, colleague in Dublin. And he said the following. This is in the highest degree novel and remarkable. Singular and unexpected consequences of the wave theory, not only unsupported by any phenomena hitherto noticed, but even opposed to all the analogies derived from experience. Airy, perhaps the most remarkable prediction that has ever been made. Now, Airy was a mean fellow, and he didn't give praise easily. I mean, he withheld it when he should have given it in some cases. Herschel, theory actually remanding back experiment to read her lesson anew, informing her of facts so strange as to appear to her impossible, and showing her all the singularities, very modern terminology, she would observe in critical cases she never dreamed of trying. Now, why this, what seems to us like hype, viewed from 100 and something years later? I think it's because this was the first time, or one of the first times anyway, that mathematics was used to predict something qualitatively new. Now, of course, for several 100 years before this, it was known with Galileo, Newton, Laplace, Lagrange, that you use mathematics to describe nature. But the phenomena to which mathematics were applied were known phenomena, eclipses, the motion of the planets, the tides, and what mathematics did was to give more precise descriptions. Here was something qualitatively new. We forget how much we've interiorized this insight. I mean, any of us now who make a theory, the first thing we do is, what do we predict from it that's new, that we didn't know before? But that was an unusual activity in those days. And I think that's the reason for all this astonishment, and the fact that Humphrey Lloyd rather quickly did an experiment, made observation. Now, there'll be a lot of pictures like this, and I want to say to you now, these are all pictures that either I made or I and my student Mike Jeffrey made in a little lab that I have in my house, and that's a story which I will tell in due course because it's an interesting aspect of the whole tale. And the original pictures were not nearly as good as this. Now, Humphrey Lloyd describes very poetically how astonishing it is to make this observation. It's a tiny little ring, it's only about a millimetre across because you can't get good thick crystals, I'll come to that later. And first of all, you don't aim your beam of light correctly. And so instead of hitting the diabolical direction, you hit some other direction and you see double refraction. And he describes how as you change the angle and you finally home in fraction of a degree, double refraction turns into conical refraction. So that was the discovery in about 1830 something. Now, you can see something there which wasn't seen by Humphrey Lloyd. There were actually two rings. This was observed a little bit later by Poggendorf. He doesn't look very happy. The reason is that, I guess, when he made this discovery in 1839, photography was only just invented, and he was pictured much later when whatever life had thrown at him had stuck. But anyway, he noticed that, which Humphrey Lloyd had not, that there are two rings. And it's interesting, it's called, separated by the Poggendorf dark space. And you read his paper, it's only about that long, and there's this one sentence we translate from German, a bright ring that encompasses a coal black sliver. That's his statement of the discovery, which was a discovery, and there it is. And later on you'll see why it is that these rings sometimes have different separations. So there's Poggendorf. Now, it took 65 years for this to be understood, even qualitatively. And it was understood by Waldemar Voigt, actually in the same volume of Annalen der Physik, where Einstein published his famous papers. A long time, 65 years. And what Voigt realized was that Hamilton had assumed an impossible idealization. He said, Hamilton had said, well, we want a perfectly narrow beam of light going in a particular direction. Why did it have to be narrow? Because if it was a broad beam, then since this cylinder is so small, you'd blur it out. We'll see precisely what that means in a little while. But Voigt realized, of course, as we all know now, that's impossible. The greater, the narrower the beam, the greater the divergence. The smaller you squeeze, the more you spread. When I made these pictures, I remembered something from my childhood. My mother was a dressmaker, and in those days, women would come to the house to be fitted with wedding dresses and the like. And in those days, women wore corsets. And the more they squeezed somewhere else, the more they spread elsewhere. We call it Heisenberg's principle now, but that's what it was. I mean, that's in, of course, in configuration space. This is in phase space, but it's the same idea. So what Voigt argued qualitatively was this: a narrow beam can't simply hit the diabolical point. It must explore a little neighborhood around. So here's the picture again. Let's look down. And here's the contribution from beam directions in the beam away from the diabolical point, this little ring, and as you approach the diabolical point, it gets smaller. It's just the area element in polar coordinates, RDR, that's all it is, 2 pi RDR. And that was his explanation. And at the point itself, you get no intensity. And that was the qualitative explanation that had to wait a long time, I'll show you, before it became quantitative. But anyway, that's Poggendorf's dark ring. Just in passing, I'll tell you something. Hamilton didn't notice, or rather, he didn't write, but Humphrey Lloyd noticed and said Hamilton surely must have noticed that this structure here is what we would nowadays call fermionic, in that if you ask about the polarization of the light that comes out, it's actually always linearly polarized. Whatever you send in, the light comes out linearly polarized, and the direction of linear polarization rotates half a time as you go around a ring. Nowadays, we know this is a consequence of the geometric phase for real symmetric matrices. As you go round a degeneracy, the eigenvectors, which are the polarization states in this problem, change sign, reverse, just the phase of pi. But there is, so if you send in, for example, linearly polarized light, you won't see all this picture. You'll just see, for example, this if you send in. Now, there's a curious aspect of this which we discovered recently. Again, this is just interrupting the general story, which is to do with the angular momentum of light. Now, you probably know, it's been written about quite a lot lately, and there's a lot of experimental activity, that light has orbital angular momentum as well as spin angular momentum. Orbital angular momentum associated with the position-dependent spatial structure of the field, and spin angular momentum associated with the polarization. And whatever you send in, the light that comes out is always linearly polarized. So suppose you send in circularly polarized light, which is the case in all the experiments I'm going to show you, you get the full structure. Then that's all spin angular momentum, but it's converted to orbital. And we showed, actually, that a curious fact, that the orbital angular momentum that comes out is half the angular momentum that goes in. So there's a little torque on the crystal. It's too small to measure, but it's just an amusing fact that a few of us found a couple of years ago. Never mind, back to the story. C.V. Raman, 1941, master of crystal optics in Bangalore. He introduced a new element into this subject. Remember, it's now nearly 40 years after Voigt, in that he realized that if you look, put your screen at different places beyond the crystal, then because of diffraction, you get different structures in the pattern. He noticed that very far away from the crystal, the rings fade and they're replaced by a central spot. Here's our picture. There are some little rings there, which we've described in due course, which he didn't mention. Well, he understood that in the fact that the cones turn over slightly away from the diabolical point. You see, here's the surface again, and I've just rotated it, and I'm talking about this turnover. There it is. So there are two directions where the light comes out forwards, but actually there aren't two. There are infinitely many, because there's a whole ring of contact. Hamilton had noticed this, actually, and remarked upon it. It's not obvious. It doesn't have to happen, but in this particular type of geometry that comes from conical refraction, it does. So there's infinitely many rays in the forward direction, which is another way of saying there's an axial caustic in the forward direction, and that's what Raman understood, why you do get this central spike, at least when you're very far away. That was nicely described, I can't remember who, by one of the biographers of Hamilton, somewhat as a plum can be laid down on a table so as to touch and rest on the table in a whole circle of contact. That's the you take the stalk out, you turn upside down, put it down. A nice picture. Well, 1941. Finally, in 1978, I mean, we've gone a long way now, many years, Belsky and Kapeliuk, working in Belarus, realized that, look, let's seriously sit down with Maxwell's equations and solve this damn thing properly. And they realized it's very important that conical refraction is a wave problem. And I like to call it conical diffraction for that reason. And the details would depend on, as I'll indeed illustrate later, on the profile of the incident light. For example, if you have a laser beam, or if you, like we do nowadays in these experiments, or in the old days, you illuminate a pinhole with sunshine. And they gave a definitive formalism, which again I'll get to. Now, Bloembergen and Schell, Bloembergen, very distinguished non-linear opticist, this is all linear optics, did the same year experiments and a very elaborate theory, which sort of fails because, in a way, it's too elaborate. It's exact, and they do calculations and they do make some observations, they agree, but they don't get the point. And the reason is that there's a simplification that they missed, which applies in practice, which makes everything comprehensible. I'll get to it in a minute. Now, 20 years later, Warnick and Arlaud did some numerical calculations based on the Belsky-Kapalyuk theory, and they found that at intermediate distances, there are faint secondary rings inside the inner Poggendorf ring, like this. You see, here's the outer ring fading away. This is going to be the central spot, but there's the inner Poggendorf, and there are some rings inside. And we've seen those too, and here are some of those rings there. There's a central spot just beginning. So a lot of things to sort of understand, I mean, the theory is, which I'll tell you now. Well, the important ingredient is paraxiality. All the angles are small, and in every experiment to date, the error in the usual paraxial approximation, which is saying that cos theta direction is 1 minus a half theta squared, the error is, you know, 1 part in a million or less. So it's good, and it enables a huge simplification. Let's set it up. Here's the beam, there's the waist of the beam, you focus it down, here's the crystal, and here's the cylinder coming out. And you measure the radial distances in units of the width of the beam when you focus it down. You measure longitudinal distance in units of, well, this is actually the Fresnel length. It's width squared over the wavelength. It's a very convenient unit in many aspects of diffraction of this sort. So that's zeta, is direction. And by the way, it's convenient to measure this from the plane inside the crystal where you would get the image of the waist if the crystal were isotropic. That's just the thing you show kids where you put a penny in a glass of water and it appears to be lifted up. It's where that is. That's the natural zero. And by the way, in experiments, if you have a lens, you can focus any of these planes onto a distant screen. So the fact that it's virtual doesn't matter. Most importantly, the radius of the beam is measured in units of the beam of the waist width, and that's this parameter rho zero, which is a single parameter governing the whole theory, the whole spatial structure of the field. It's a single parameter replacing the width, the thickness, and the three principal dielectric constants. And if you don't make the paraxial approximation, you've got to carry all this junk along with you. In the experiments, this is about 60, which is what I'm going to show you. And it's the conical refraction is an emergent phenomenon as rho zero gets large. When it's small, then you just blur out the structure. If the ring isn't large compared to the width of the beam, as I said before, detail will be blurred out. So you want it to be large. So what is the theory? Well, you take the... It's very convenient to write the electric D vector. You could do it with E, but it's easier with D. We know everything about plane waves, but we have to superpose them to make a beam. And to superpose them, we need the Fourier transform transverse of the beam. For example, Gaussian, doesn't have to be. We have to superpose these waves. And when you do that, the theory, you go through it and so on. This is my version of it. I found this actually not realizing that Belsky and Kapalyuk had done it before. But this way of looking at it is actually a bit simpler for physicists. So here's the vector field that comes out at a place where you're looking, okay, in configuration space. Here's the polarization that you send in, whatever it may be. It could depend on position, but I'm assuming for a moment it doesn't. It's not an important detail. And what's this? Well, this is a vector, and that's a vector, so this must be a matrix. That's the unit matrix. This is a combination of the two real Pauli matrices and the transverse coordinates. And these things are these Belsky-Kapalyuk integrals. They're integrals involving, well, Bessel function, because of the usual circular symmetry, you always get them, and involving the structure of the beam. So this is a superposition. And you see, they involve where you are, rho and zeta, and transversely and longitudinally, and this parameter, rho zero. Now, this isn't an integral that is any special function, even if you put in simple forms for A. It's close to, but not. But you can learn a lot. Well, for example, you can compute it. That's not difficult to do. And then you can see that the rings transform into the central spot as you recede. Let's look at that in more detail. Here's a case where you see everything. Here's the Poggendorf dark ring. Here's the two Poggendorf bright rings. there's the central spot just beginning to come, and here are these secondary rings. So all the structure is there. Geometrical optics. You see, this is a proper wave theory, but of course you can do quantitative geometrical optics in the way Hamilton didn't do. He could have done, but he didn't. And there are two ways you can do that. You either can take these intervals and do the stationary phase approximation, which is the way one commonly nowadays gets rays out of waves, or you can just start from the beginning with a Hamiltonian for the motion. He never actually wrote it down in the way that we would recognize, although it was obviously in his mind. But you can do either, and then you have to take the Jacobian between the initial and final. That's the way you get intensities in ray theory. And here it is for a Gaussian beam. And I want to draw attention to one particular thing. You see, here's this factor is rho minus rho zero. This vanishes at the radius of the ring in the corresponding to the diabolical singularity. And of course, that's the Poggedorf dark ring. It's an anti-caustic. Instead of the rays becoming infinitely amplified, as they do at caustics, which are the common singularities, here you have an unusual circumstance. You have an anti-caustic. It's zero there. Well, here you see as you move farther and farther away from the crystal, you see these rings separating, and then finally this central spot appears there. Well, how does that compare with wave physics? Well, it's actually pretty good. Of course, these secondary rings, and there's rings surrounding the central spot here as well, which aren't given by geometrical optics, and their interference phenomenon, a very interesting one, actually, which I'll briefly mention again at the end, because I learned something fundamental from it, but about mathematics. But here, what it is, it's interference between a geometrical ray and a diffracted ray scattered from the diabolical point in momentum space. So it's a diffracted wave that comes from the singularity. And then you make that precise. It comes from understanding the asymptotics of those integrals, that interpretation. Good. There's something else you can do before I get to experiments, a couple more things. One is you'd like to know the shape of the rings. Now, when rho zero is large, you can look in the neighborhood of the rings, very far from the origin, look at these two rings, and there's a nice uniform asymptotics you can make, which in the case of I'll write it for a Gaussian beam, there's only a single function involved, don't worry about these details, but what the function is, it's some combination of Bessel's, and don't even worry about it, and the intensity in the rings is the following, it's this function of distance from the rings, which goes from the argument goes from real to complex as you increase the distance. And so it's interesting to look at zeta equals zero, because this will show you the sharpest focus you can get inside the crystal, and you look with a lens, you can project it outside, of the incident laser beam, which would just, without this phenomenon, would just be another Gaussian, would just be focused. And here's the shape. It's a very interesting, nice universal shape. It has all this nice structure that you can you can calculate. And I'm showing you this because I want to show how different it is if you look with an illuminated pinhole. Illuminated pinhole, top hat function, for a transform is a Bessel function, and you do work out the integrals there and do this asymptotics. And there, instead of Bessel function, you've got elliptic integrals, and instead of the focus of a sharp pinhole, which is an illuminated disk, would be this. And that will be worth seeing. I mean, these are the two rings. There's the Poggendorf dark, and way over here is the origin. There's the ring profile. Nobody's ever seen this, and I think it would be worth looking for. It involves a kind of experiment a bit more difficult than the kitchen table experiments that I can do. One more thing. Fringes surrounding the central spot when you're very far away. That's interesting. They come from the interference of two geometrical rays. Now, the geometric rays have perpendicular polarizations, and you know from elementary physics that orthogonal states that are orthogonally polarized don't interfere. But that's in the geometrical optics approximation. If you go one order beyond, you can get weak interference because they're no longer orthogonal, and in fact, the intensity is the sum of the squares of these Bessel functions, which are these weak shoulders. what I've drawn here is with the appropriate scaling, as you go farther and farther away and do the scaling, you condense onto this Bessel squared thing, whose shoulders, flat inflections, are at the zeros of the Bessel function J1. So we know pretty well everything about this phenomenon, and this was the situation in 2004 when I went to Dublin. And there I met James Lunning, and he said, "Do you know next year is Hamilton's bicentenary?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." He said, "Have you heard of conical refraction?" I said, "Well, I've just been working on the theory of it." And he said, "Well, would you like to see it?" So I said, "Yes." And he explained something to me, which I hadn't realized. But just as I knew that the theory papers on this subject were very few and far between, one every 30, 40 years or something, you know, I've told you everything about all of them pretty well, so the experimental papers were very few and far between. The reason is that these experiments were difficult because it's very hard to get crystals of sufficient purity for them to be thick enough, for the ring to be big enough to see. And Humphrey Lloyd describes how he had his little bits of aragonite and he aimed his pinhole here, here and here until he finally found a bit that was clear enough and only about a millimetre of ring. Even Bloomberg, the master of crystal optics, said, "We found our crystal in the private collection of somebody or other. And it's hard to grow those particular crystals." And what James Lunny told me is that there's a German company, VCT Technologies, which to celebrate Hamilton Year was marketing crystals of this monoclinic double tongue state. Don't ask me what it is. To demonstrate conical refraction, because it's a phenomenon that you see in the last pages of Landau and Lifshitz and Born and Wolf, but nobody ever looks in detail at it. So I said, "Well, I'd love to see." And so he took me to his lab, and I said, "By the way, do you know about the Poggendorf dark space?" He said, "No." "Do you know about the Raman spot?" He said, "No." I said, "Do you know about these inner rings?" "No." In about a minute, we'd seen all of that, which was really marvellous. And so I determined there and then that I wanted one of these crystals, and to give demonstrations, not when I travel abroad, but to drive around the country with lasers and do it. I thought, you know, maybe it would be possible for me to see it. So I decided to buy a crystal from this company. And when I discovered where they were, I decided to go in person to collect the crystal, because I was curious to see, as I'm sure you would have been, the place, which is under the green fields just outside Hanover, in an old nuclear bomb shelter. And it was the nuclear shelter, the command center of Deutsche Telekom. And had there been a nuclear war, that's where communications would have taken place between them and hopefully the Warsaw Pact and NATO, London, Washington, whatever. And they told me that when they moved in, there were these huge cables with about 1,000 wires in, all cut off, because they didn't use it anymore. And they asked Roche, to say, "Which one of these is the telephone?" It took a week to find out. Anyway, it's perfect for crystal growing, because you need very still air, and you need very clean air. And in this nuclear shelter, for obvious reasons, the air was filtered through lots of beds of little nanoparticles, rather beds of sand to remove any nanoparticles. So it's very clean, good for crystal growing. And they had a company of like troglodytes, imported crystal growers from Novosibirsk, who were apparently the best crystal growers. They were working away like the dwarves in the underground in a mountain. And so I bought their crystal. Now, it turned out that my crystal was better than James Lunny's. Let me make a point. He'd bought two, and they only sold three. So it was an unsuccessful piece of marketing on their part, and they've stopped doing it now. But ours was best. And so we've quickly realized, Mike, Jeffrey, and I, that we wouldn't just demonstrate the theory, we could test it quantitatively with our crystal. So here we are again, and we need to understand these quantities. Well, never mind the details. We could focus down the crystal. We focused it down to about 7 microns, and then we could measure this rho zero by projection onto a screen, and it was about 60, like I said. And so we made a number of measurements. It's hard to estimate the zeta, because it's very sensitively dependent on the actual physical distance, but never mind, we did it. So look, here's the first set of things. We took pictures, and by the way, with a digital camera, Theorists like us, we can persuade ourselves that we're experimentalists because we can do things that would have required image capture equipment, which would cost sort of tens of thousands of dollars a few years ago. So with my digital camera, we wanted to compare theory. Now here's theory as you go away from the as you go away from the screen, and here's experiment. Now it looks pretty good, and little things that aren't quite the same. But what else you can do is you can again, instead of having image processing software, which again would have cost thousands of dollars a few years ago, you can just put the JPEG into Mathematica and do all kinds of stuff. For example, angular averaging to get the radial patterns. And there you see, again, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good. There are no parameters in this, no scaling at all. No manipulation, only just scaling of intensity, but that's all. So we thought this was okay, and so we tried to make some more precise measurements. So one thing we could measure geometrically is how the width of the rings and the distance between the dark ring and the outer ring change as you go away from the crystal. And well, that worked well, good, fine. On a finer scale, we wanted to look at the interference, so we could measure the width of those first two rings, the Poggendorf ring and this inner ring interference phenomenon I told you about. And that agrees very well as a function of distance. And much farther away, you've got those little central rings around the central spot, these Bessel zeros. And there, too, we had good agreement. So we were very pleased with this. And we considered that this 175-year multinational story was, at least for the moment, finished. Well, it wasn't finished, and I'll explain that in a second. But before I do, I want to point out that although these experiments are difficult, there are other experiments you can do which are not. And this is do-it-yourself conoscopy. Those of you who were here 5 years ago might remember me showing this, but I'm going to show it again anyway. Well, I talked about other things then. You see, instead of having a thick crystal and doing this geometrical optics, you can have a thin crystal. This is what mineralogists do under polarizing microscope. The two waves get out of step with each other, and you can see a lot of this momentum space structure using interference. And the way you do it, you have a black light sandwich. A black light sandwich, think of it quantum mechanically. This polarizer prepares the state, but what's inside propagates the state, and what you finally put there measures the state. It's not an analogy, actually, is the case with this, except that we're not measuring photon by photon. But anyway, that's what you can do. And but then you see, we had a problem as theorists. What do you put inside here? We can't get these big slabs of aragonite. But it turns out that there's another substance which, as physicists, we were all very familiar with for years and years and years, which has exactly this biaxial property that we need. And that's overhead projector transparency foil. That's the filling in the sandwich. The bread is too cross-polarized. You can do this yourself. It's really remarkable how I don't see one here, but many places you go, there's this piece of legacy technology, kind of sad and unloved in the corner, getting all dusty with this transparency. And for 30 years or so, we use this stuff for its proper, without realizing it had this wonderful property. I learned it from Rajendra Bhandari in the Raman Institute, and we wrote about it in a kind of more modern way as a demonstration. But when I talked to my polymer colleagues, my optic colleagues didn't know it. My polymer colleagues, they didn't know, but immediately they understand in the process of manufacture why this must be so. Anyway, it is so. So what do you do with it? Well, you just look through it, actually. You make this black light sandwich and you hold it up at some diffuse surface, it's lit. Because what's looking? I wrote a paper a couple of years ago about looking. There are all kinds of interesting things you can say about it, but the simplest thing is that looking is, with your eye in a particular place, you see the light coming from a particular direction. So you're looking at, as you look across the field of view, you're seeing the light that's come in different directions. So you're scanning momentum space by looking. And you can do it that way, or you can have a little torch bulb and you can shine, or you can even use an overhead projector to project onto a screen, what I've just told you. And when you do that, you see these conoscopic figures you see in the optics textbooks. What I've described is by far the easiest way to make it, very dramatic. And here you see two, okay, what are these fringes? They're loci of constant separation of the two wave surfaces, because that's what the phase is proportional to. And of course, near the bullseyes, which are these diabolical points in momentum space, they're locally circles, because the cones are locally circular. And then finally, you've got this black brush, and I won't go into detail, but that's this pi geometric phase I mentioned before, which comes, it's a consequence of this half rotation. If you have a uniaxial crystal, then those two optic axes come together, these come together, and this is replaced by a black cross, actually. That's the signature. Very good. Well, if you take one of these and put it in front of your camera and go outside in the sun, then you get this decorating every picture that you take. So here's the garden of the physics department where I work. And you learn actually something unexpected from this. You learn that the blue sky isn't as blue as you think it is. It's very unsaturated. It's almost white. Your eye thinks it's very blue, but all those colors are there. You haven't added them. Anyway, that's the structure. That's do-it-yourself kernoscopy. Now let me go back to finish with. You see, we realized that there are two generalizations of this situation that Hamilton envisaged, and they're generalizations which radically change the mathematical structure underneath. I've just occasionally, casually mentioned this degeneracies of real symmetric matrices as a function of parameters, which is a conical structure. But it's very different if you change the physics, as there are two very natural ways to do. And the first one is to incorporate optical activity. So if the crystal is chiral as well as anisotropic, if the underlying crystal is not the same as its mirror image, that again depends on the crystal symmetry. Well, what happens then? Well, the diabolical point gets smoothed away and the cones separate. Mathematically, that's because the underlying structure now involves all three Pauli matrices, and it's the degeneracies of complex Hermitian matrices, which by the Wigner von Neumann theorem need three parameters, but you've only got two, namely the space of looking, sky space as it's been called. You've only got two, and so you generally don't get a degeneracy. And the question is then, what happens to the patterns I've been describing? Very dramatic things happen. So let me just show you. This is what we've seen already, unfamiliar way. This is with zero chirality, okay. Then here, leave going from the crystal, enormously compressed. Here's the dark, here are rays, so here's the dark space. There it is again, the dark ring. Here are the two bright rings, and here's the Raman central spike beginning to develop. The moment you switch on chirality, what you get is this amazing thing. You get a caustic, a cusped focal cone with a spike springing out from the Hamilton-Poggendorf ring. And the height of this is 1/sigma. It's a very singular limit, actually, how you go from one to the other. Well, you can do the whole theory with this this generalization. And there's a poor way, poor person's way of doing wave optics, which is to say, you take the rays, all of them, and you endow them with phase and you superpose them as amplitudes. And that works pretty well everywhere, except that on caustics it gives you infinity, where, of course, the true wave physics is finite. And but this still, it looks quite good. Here's the exact calculation. But this local structure here is a particular special function. It's sometimes been called the Bessoid singularity. It's not a cusp. It looks like a cusp, but it isn't, because it's rotational, and the usual cusp that's structurally stable doesn't have this spike down the middle. But you can compare the Bessoid spun cusp approximation with this, and there are other approximations I won't go into that you can check at different parts of the pattern, and we understand it completely, but it hasn't been observed. It would be very good for someone to see this structure. It would be quite hard to see. I don't want to talk about this. Right, now the second thing you can do is you can introduce absorption. Now, of course, you do have absorption and dissipation, decoherence, whatever you want to call it, and it's direction dependent, usually. And the principal axes of the imaginary part of the direction usually don't coincide with the principal axes of the real part. So this can be quite complicated. The question is, what happens then? What happens then is the following. You've got degeneracies of non-Hermitian matrices, which are completely different in their structure. I mean, I give a whole lecture about this, but I'm not going to now. But instead of conical intersections, you have branch points, and each degeneracy of the real symmetric matrix splits into two branch points. So the sheets are now connected in a way that they weren't before. And you ask, well, what effect does that have? Well, of course, the main effect is everything gets exponentially absorbed as you go through. But within that, what's the structure? It turns out to be marvelously rich. You quantify the absorption by a vector delta. It's a non-Hermitian traceless part of a 2x2 complex symmetric matrix. And but then you have this problem. How do you choose the direction of the incident beam? You see, previously we just shone it in the diabolical direction. But now do you choose one or the other or halfway between? Well, you let it be variable, let it be arbitrary. Kappa zero is the direction. Another two-component vector. Now, the remarkable thing is, first surprise, is that at least for Gaussian beams and approximately for others, the effect of these two vectors is captured by a single scalar variable. Very remarkable. What that means is that the effect of absorption could be mimicked by misalignment. Now, misalignment, we know. You misalign every time you try this experiment until you get it right. And then the second is that the only effect is to complexify the radial variable in the diffraction integrals. Instead of being psi squared plus eta squared, it becomes anisotropic and complex. And again, you can work out everything. The effects of this are profound, actually. Just to remark quickly, this is a picture like what I showed you before of double refraction going to conical refraction, but slightly farther from the crystal than what I first showed you. But if you now, with this theory, you realize that you get the same structure if you start from a crystal without absorption, and then you add absorption, anisotropic absorption, you get the same structure, which is a very surprising thing. Well, here are some pictures. Here's geometrical optics, and here's exact wave optics, and they're pretty similar, except near here. But I want to show you something here. And what I want to show you is the third surprise. It's what happens if you look on at very faint parts of the pattern, which you reveal with a logarithmic intensity plot. Now, what you see there is you see a dark ring of geometrical interference between the rays. Now, once again, I've said before, if the rays are orthogonally polarized, you don't get interference. But these rays are the eigenvectors of a non-Hermitian matrix, and they're not orthogonal. In fact, at a diabolical point, they're even parallel. So they can interfere. So this is a profoundly non-Hermitian effect, this ring. And there are certain places where the intensity is exactly zero. You zoom in and you get these dark spots. Now, these have never been seen, these structures. And I encountered a rather frustrating phenomenon when we made this theory, because we wanted to say to experimentalists, take this crystal, we look on tables of crystal behavior, and you should see this effect that's never been seen before. But then we found that there is not a single crystal of any sort for which all the numbers we want are actually tabulated. You know, we thought you would find a crystal, for hundreds of crystals you would see the three principal refractive indices, real part, the three principal refractive indices, the imaginary part, and the little rotation matrix which takes one set of axes into the other. It seemed pretty simple. There are bits and pieces of these numbers which people have needed over the years, but for no one crystal did we find what we wanted. So it's a job for somebody who's interested in this to actually measure and look at this little curious corner of crystal optics. I've got a lot of points to summarize with this. The first conclusion is that this led to one of the first qualitatively new phenomena predicted by mathematics. I told you that. It's one of the original phenomena in singular optics. In the last years, we begin to look at optics in a slightly unusual way. This has been taken up now by many experimentalists. There are meetings about it, which is instead of solving Maxwell's equations and on the computer or using special functions and doing whatever you want to do with your optics, you look at the singularities of the field, caustics in geometrical optics, the phase singularities, optical vortices in scalar optics, or the polarization singularities in vector optics. And from this point of view, this Hamilton phenomenon was the first example of singular optics and singular optics of polarized light in retrospect. Curiously enough, actually, in the same decade, Airy gave his first theory of how you decorate a caustic with waves. That's the Airy function. So that's singular optics of caustics. And William Whewell in in understanding the pattern of interference of tide waves, found the first phase singularities identified. There are two of them in the North Sea. So curiously enough, all these people knew each other but didn't realize that this would become a branch of way of looking at optics through singularities, a very modern point of view. Well, there was Hamilton anyway. Now, after Hamilton, almost nobody any longer doubted that light is a transverse wave phenomenon. It was before Maxwell, but it was the elastic solid theory for Fresnel. But after this experiment, nobody really doubted, except Brewster, who was a kind of curious old stick in the mud. And he resisted for a long time, but this was a crucial experiment in the history of optics, transverse vibration. I've mentioned it was the first substantial application of phase space, that is to predict something new, not just illustrating old Newton equations, which is the elementary thing that you do. Position and direction on equal footing. I mean, this was this whole talk. You've seen it's a sort of symphony of position and direction. You look in position space on screen, but what you see is determined by a structure in momentum space, namely this conical intersection. You need ray and wave physics to understand fully everything that's going on. It led to some unusual asymptotics. I'll very briefly talk about that. I don't want to. It's another lecture. It's to do with competing exponentials. You know, interference is about you have two exponentials and they superpose, and you have a large one and you have a small one, and the small one gives you a decoration. It depends on the imaginary part of the phase that gives you exponential attenuation, and here I found that the wave which had the larger negative part of the exponent, which should have been decaying, was actually bigger than the other one, and that seemed kind of crazy. And it's to do with the different behaviour of the prefactors. It turns out it's a universal phenomenon that. I call it dominance by subdominant exponentials. I wrote about it a couple of years ago. Is that it's almost everywhere in asymptotics we have competing exponentials where the two exponentials have different mathematical origins. One could be a saddle point of an integral and one could be an end point, for example. Then there is always a domain of parameters very close to the domain where the two exponents have the same real part and so they interfere, but there's a domain where this curious reversal occurs where the wrong exponential is the bigger one. So that was an interesting thing that came out of it. I thought I made a mistake when I started doing the asymptotic, but it wasn't a mistake. It's the first conical intersection in physics. Now, theoretical chemists will tell you that there's an activity in quantum chemistry nowadays called conical intersection chemistry. And this is to do with Born-Oppenheimer approximation for molecules, where you have a molecule which is a lot of nuclei and a lot of electrons, and too many to solve the Schrödinger equation. So you take advantage of the fact that the nuclei are heavy and slow, and the electrons are swift, and solve their Schrödinger equation before the nuclei have time to move. It's called Born-Oppenheimer approximation. And then the electron energies provide a potential in which you then do the nuclear quantum mechanics. And this is very good. It's universally used in chemistry, except that whenever you have a degeneracy, whenever the nuclear configuration is such that when you solve the Schrödinger equation, you get a degeneracy, this approximation breaks down. And there are various phenomena in quantum chemistry associated with that breaking down, which are now extensively studied. But what the quantum chemists don't realize, unless they've heard me talk about this, that the first of these conical intersections was actually Hamilton. It's a degeneracy of eigenvalues of a matrix depending on parameters. The parameters in the chemistry case are the positions of the nuclei. In optics, they're the directions that I've described. Well, once you realize that, of course, and when you realize that the paraxial wave equation is the same as has the same form as a time-dependent Schrödinger equation in two dimensions, you realize that all of this theory, Belsky and Kapanuk and my version of it that I told you, gives an exactly solvable model for the evolution of a two-state quantum system involving a conical intersection of energy levels. And these models are rare and precious, so exactly solvable models. So that's just a transposition of the theories. The theory is extended, as I've told you. You could include non-linearity, which include chirality and absorption. But also, Alan Newell has incorporated non-linearity. Now, that's a very beautiful theoretical extension that he's made. He expresses the equation in a very nice way, but so far, we haven't yet got any qualitative conclusions out of what the nonlinear theory will predict is different from what I've told you. There will be things, but this is an early stage. It's a significant development by him. Continuing stimulus for experiments beyond the ones beyond Raman, beyond Pogorelov, I should say, also beyond us, these phenomena that I mentioned haven't been seen yet. There was money in it. This company, VCT Technologies, offered $10,000 for the best application of conical refraction. Now, I'll tell you something which amuses me about this phenomenon. It seems to occur nowhere in the natural universe, okay? Because it's a singular thing. You have to aim and contrive. I mean, lots of effects of anisotropy, of course, but not this particular phenomenon, beam going, hitting a crystal in a ring, okay? It also doesn't seem to have any useful applications. Now, however, it's kind of fundamental because it's the very heart of the crystal optics is this singularity, it's this singular place in old-fashioned crystal optics. So it's kind of amusing. Well, they didn't get any takers, and so they've abandoned this prize now. However, James Lunny and his colleague John Donegan do have a project where they're looking at this possibility that the cylinder of bright light that comes out might be useful in optical tweezer experiments to do things that the ordinary Gaussian beam that everybody uses might not be able to do. I don't know how well that is, that's progressing, but you know, they have some ideas about how it might be useful there. And finally, it's natural that most people who do physics, and it's certainly true of people in this institute, are working on problems that are of current common interest. We could say fashion-driven, but that's disparaging, and I don't mean to be. You know, string theory, quantum gravity, and so on, and you have to look at on the archive and see what people have posted, and you look at physical letters and see, what people are doing who are working on the same field as you. But this subject, what I've been talking about, well, you can think of it as a 175-year antidote to short-term science. Anyway, thank you very much.
So the going back to the polarization, doing a half flip,
yes,
if you're around.
Yes.
So what creates a symmetry in the directions? In some places,
oh, because it's what it is. It's of course underlying it. The crystal has its principal axes,
uh-huh.
And they're fixed in space. Where however you want to orient crystal.
Okay.
So that's what it does. That's what it is.
So instead of having chirality, could you just aim a magnetic field parallel to the beam, and then you can dial the strength?
Yeah, which is a Faraday effect.
Right.
Yeah, which is effectively a similar thing. I haven't worked that out in detail, but it would. I don't need to work that in detail. I can see immediately. Yes, it would have the same effect. And what the numbers are, I'm not sure what the Faraday coefficient is compared to natural optical activity. In crystals, but for crystals which are magnetic, then
it might be technologically simpler.
It might be. Yeah. Yeah. People have mentioned this before, and I've said, as I'm saying now, yes, what a good idea. Now I've forgotten.
What if one reverse the time direction? So let's say we feed in this tone. The cylinder. We feed in the cylinder, we would get out a very narrow beam. Now, if we feed in not the cylinder, but just something that's not necessarily a cylinder, but it's going in this direction, not necessarily has the right polarization.
Mm.
So some stuff will come out of the other end, but among it, there's going to be this very narrow beam. Maybe that would be useful.
That's a good point. I mean, it'd be quite unstable, it'd be quite sensitive, because it's a very special structure. But yes, you're right, this would happen. Yeah.
Could you comment a few on your sign change related
to this? Well, yes, I mean the fermionic sign change is just it comes to the fact that spin half is described by the Pauli matrices, and the Pauli matrices have the property that if you have physics governed by the Pauli matrices, for example, the neutron, and you turn it by
a half turn, which predict, as Harloff and Susskind predicted many decades ago, then the phase will change sign. And so if you take two beams, and one of which you do rotate by 2 pi, another one you don't, you interfere them, the interference range will shift by half a fringe, as you can see. So it's simply the fact that I call it fermionic, but because that's how we tend to think nowadays, but it's just a property of 2 by 2 real symmetric matrices when you make a circuit in the space of the parameters on which they depend.
Okay. It's going to get me skin or...
Right, precisely, yeah, exactly. But I didn't say that. But yes, it is. Exactly so. Yeah.
I was wondering, coming back to this,
yes,
changing the time direction. Actually, if what we have is diffuse light coming from all directions, mm, unpolarized, then shining it onto the crystal will have the effect that there should be an error being created.
That's a good point. I haven't thought about that. Faint, of course, but yes, interesting. It should be sort of a focusing element, is what you're saying. Yes, interesting. It's easy to do, actually.